Hey guys, this is Yom Joshi with Superior North. Welcome back to my channel. Today we will be talking about a stock that was suggested in the Barron's newspaper recently. That stock is called Petrobras. Petrobras is an integrated energy company that is controlled by the Brazilian government. In this video, we will be getting a business overview by going over Petrobras's three business segments, then review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios, and finally find the intrinsic value of the company. So let's dive in and review Petrobras.
Hey guys, let's start off by looking at the Form 20-F, which is the annual report that Petrobras filed with the SEC. On page 14 of this report, the company gives us an idea of its three business segments. The first one is its exploration and production segment. This segment covers the activities of exploration, development, and production of crude oil, natural gas liquids, and natural gas in Brazil and abroad for the primary purpose of supplying its domestic refineries. The exploration and production segment also operates through partnerships with other companies, including holding interests in non-Brazilian companies in this segment. The second business segment is its refining, transportation, and marketing segment, also known as its refining segment. This segment covers the activities of refining, logistics, transport, marketing, and trading of crude oil and oil products in Brazil and abroad, exports of ethanol, petrochemical operations such as extraction and processing of shale, as well as holding interest in petrochemical companies in Brazil. The third business segment is its gas and power segment. This segment covers the activities of logistics and trading of natural gas and electricity, transportation and trading of liquefied natural gas, generation of electricity by means of thermoelectric power plants, as well as holding interest in transportation and distribution companies of natural gas in Brazil and abroad. This segment also includes natural gas processing and fertilizer operations. Now let's look at the revenue breakdown across these three segments. For the fiscal year that ended in 2020, the refining, transportation, and marketing segment had the highest top-line number. That is, across all the three operating segments, that segment brought in the most amount of money via sales. However, by the time we get to the net income number, that is, by the time that operating segment paid for its expenses and costs, it only had about $77 million left. When we compare each segment's net income number to those of its sales numbers, for the exploration and production segment, the company is able to realize about 13% of that segment's sales as its net income. For the refining, transportation, and marketing segment, less than 0.5% of the company's net sales actually results in its net income number. And for the gas and power segment, about 11.5% of that segment's sales results in its net income number. In short, we can say that even though the refining, transportation, and marketing segment brings in majority of the company's sales, the exploration and production segment is the one that's most profitable. We see a similar trend in the year 2019. That is, even though the refining, transportation, and marketing segment brought in majority of the company's sales for that year, the exploration and production and gas and power were the two main drivers of the company's net income numbers. Now that we have a brief understanding of Petrobras's business and its three operating segments, let's review the company's fundamentals by focusing on its key ratios. I'm on Morningstar looking at Petrobras. Under key ratios, we have the financials. The first item on the list is the revenue. The revenue is the top line of the income statement. This is the amount of money that the company brings in via sales. Back in 2011, the company's revenue was about $146 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $74 billion. Over the past 10 years, we do see a sharp drop in the company's revenue in 2015. This is after the corruption scandal that got erupted back in 2014. Similarly, we do see a drop in the company's revenue in 2020, which was due to the declining sales due to the pandemic. Next is the operating income. The operating income is the amount of money that's left with the company once we subtract the cost of goods and operating expenses from the company's revenue. Back in 2011, the company's operating income was about $31.3 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $28.8 billion. It's interesting to see how even though in 2015, when the company's revenue went down, its operating income went up. This is due to the fact that before 2015, the company was involved in a lot of corrupt practices, including bribery and price fixing, kind of like a cartel. However, once the company cleaned up those acts, its operating margin improved and has been trending upwards ever since. After that, looking at the net income is the amount of money that's left with the company once it pays for the cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes. Back in 2011, the company's net income was about $20 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $26 billion. Over the past 10 years, there were 4 years when the company's net income was negative. That is, from 2014 through 2017, the company reported a loss. And for a company that has a lot of fixed assets, this is rather common because it's going to have a lot of below-the-line expenses that is going to cause years where the company reports negative net income number. Next is the dividends per share. Back in 2011, the company paid out about 17 cents per share as dividend. After 2012, the company stopped paying out dividends all the way until 2018 when it paid out about 13 cents per share as dividend. And for the trailing 12 months, that company paid out about 91 cents per share as dividend. The company decreased its dividends in the year 2020 when the company's sales dropped off due to the pandemic. However, it has been paying out dividends ever since 2018. Next is the shares outstanding. Back in 2011, the company had about 6,522 million shares outstanding, and it is the same number today. That is, the company still has 6,522 million shares outstanding. So the company is neither issuing more shares nor buying back its shares. This means that if you were a shareholder back in 2011, you still have the same ownership and same part of the company. Next is the book value per share. The book value is what we get when we subtract the company's total liabilities from its total assets. Back in 2012, the company's book value was about $26 per share. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $11 per share. Over the past 10 years, the company's book value per share has always been positive, which tells us that the company always had more assets than liabilities on its balance sheet. We do see a significant drop off in the year 2015. This is after the corruption scandal, which resulted in the company actually reporting a fair and true book value number. Finally, looking at the free cash flow. The free cash flow is what we get when we subtract the company's capital spending from its operating cash flow. Back in 2011, the company's free cash flow was negative because its capital spending exceeded its operating cash flow. In 2012, the company's free cash flow was about $2 billion. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about $29.6 billion. Ideally, we wanted the company's free cash flow number to be positive, staying steady or increasing. And we can see that the company has been reporting a positive free cash flow number, which has, for the most part, been trending upwards ever since 2015. To keep our discounted free cash flow DCF analysis realistic, I will be using the average of the past 3 years of free cash flows for my discounted free cash flow DCF analysis. Now let's look at the profitability of the company, focusing on the net margin. The net margin is the ratio of the company's bottom line to its top line, so it compares the company's net income to its revenue. Back in 2011, the company's net margin was about 13.79%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 34.87%. What this means is every $100 that the company made over the past 12 months, by the time it paid for its cost of goods, operating expenses, non-operating expenses, interest on its debt obligations, and taxes, it had $34.87 left as pure profit. We can see that there were 4 years from 2014 through 2017 when the company's net margin numbers were negative. This is because during those years, the company reported a negative net income number. Next is the return on equity. The return on equity is the ratio of the company's income to its shareholders' equity. Warren Buffett prefers to only invest in securities that have a return on equity of 8% or greater every year for the past 10 years. Back in 2011, the company's return on equity was about 13%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 46%. The three ways of increasing a company's return on equity number is first, when the company buys back its shares. Second is when the company becomes more leveraged, that is when it takes on more debt. And third is when it actually reports a higher net income number. After that, looking at the return on invested capital, this number gives an idea of how good the management is at allocating the company's capital and getting a return on that investment. Back in 2011, the company's return on invested capital was about 8%, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 23.82%. Petrobras' weighted average cost of capital, also known as the company's hurdle rate, is about 7.84%. And since the company's return on invested capital is greater than its weighted average cost of capital, we can safely say that the management is creating value for its shareholders. Finally, looking at the interest coverage. The interest coverage is the ratio of the company's income to its interest obligations. So it gives us an idea of how many times can the company pay off its interest using its income in that calendar year. Benjamin Graham, the father of value investing, preferred to only invest in securities that had interest coverage of 5 times or higher. Back in 2011, the company's interest coverage was about 19.77 times. And for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 7.26 times. What this means is the company can pay off its interest obligations 7.26 times using its income that it generated over the past 12 months. Now let's look at the financial health and liquidity ratios. The first item on the list is the current ratio. The current ratio compares the company's current assets to its current liabilities. Ideally, we want to see the company's current ratio to be greater than 1.0, as that tells us that the company has enough assets to fulfill its liabilities over the next 12 months. Back in 2011, the company's current ratio was at 1.78, and for the latest quarter, it's at 1.20. Next is the quick ratio. The quick ratio is similar to the current ratio, except we disregard the inventory component. In other words, quick ratio is equal to current assets minus inventory divided by current liabilities. Ideally, we want the company's quick ratio to be greater than 1.0, as that tells us that the company would not have to rely on selling its inventory in order to fulfill its current liabilities. Back in 2011, the company's quick ratio was at 1.28. And for the latest quarter, it's at 0.69. Next, looking at the financial leverage. The financial leverage is the ratio of the company's total assets to its shareholders' equity. A high financial leverage tells us that more of the company's assets are financed via liabilities. A financial leverage of 1.0 would tell us that all of the company's assets are financed via shareholders' equity. A financial leverage of 2.0 would tell us that half of the company's total assets are financed via liabilities and half of them are financed via shareholders' equity. Back in 2011, the company's financial leverage was at 1.82, and for the latest quarter, it's at 2.64. The company's financial leverage has slowly been trending downwards ever since 2015. Finally, looking at the debt-to-equity ratio, this ratio compares the company's total debt to its shareholders' equity. Ideally, we want the company's debt-to-equity ratio to be less than 1.0. It's even better if it's less than 0.5. Back in 2011, the company's debt-to-equity ratio was at 0.41, and for the latest quarter, it's at 0.74. Petrobras' debt-to-equity ratio has a similar trend as the company's financial leverage. That is, both of them have been trending downwards ever since 2015. Now let's look at the efficiency ratios. The first item on the list is the day sales outstanding. This number gives an idea of how many days go by from the day the company recognizes its sale to the day it actually receives cash for that service rendered. Back in 2011, the company's day sales outstanding was about 28 days, and for the trailing 12 months, it's about 17 days. Ideally, we want the company's day sales outstanding number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day sales outstanding number is growing rapidly, as that tells us that the company's management is being aggressive with its accounting, as it's trying to recognize its revenue sooner so that it can inflate its income numbers on its income statement. However, in the case of Petrobras, yes, the company's day sales outstanding number has been trending upwards since 2017. However, it's not growing at a rapid pace where it's a cause of concern, but it's certainly something to keep an eye on. Next is the day's inventory. This number gives an idea of how many days is the company's products sit in its inventory before it's sold. Back in 2011, the company's day's inventory was about 49 days, and for the trailing 12 months, that number was about 63 days. Ideally, we want the company's day's inventory number to be staying steady or decreasing. What we do not want to see is a company whose day's inventory number is increasing, because all that tells us that the company's products are just sitting around on its balance sheet. We rather see those assets, that inventory, being pushed onto the company's income statement and be materialized as a profit. Petrobras' day's inventory did see an increase in the year 2019 and 2020. However, for the trailing 12 months, the company's day's inventory is back to the pre-COVID levels. Next is the payables period. This number gives an idea of how many days does the company take to pay its suppliers. Back in 2011, the company took about 41 days to pay its suppliers. And for the trailing 12 months, the company took about 49 days to pay its suppliers. Petrobras' payables period has been trending upwards since 2017. What we do not want to see is a company whose payables period is growing rapidly, as it tells us that the company's management may be holding on to its cash in order to inflate its cash flow numbers on its cash flow statement. And that is what we saw in the year 2020 when the company tried to hold on to its cash, which is why we see a big increase in the company's payables period in the year 2020. But for the trailing 12 months, that number is back down to the pre-COVID level. Finally, looking at the inventory turnover, this number gives an idea of how many times does the company go through its inventory in a calendar year. For the year 2011, the company went through its inventory about 7.38 times. And for the trailing 12 months, the company went through its inventory about 5.75 times. When we look at the past 10-year trend, we can see that the company was more efficient at going through its inventory 10 years ago than it is today. Now let's look at Petrobras' current valuation. The first item on the list is the price-to-earnings ratio. Petrobras' PE is at 4.8. The company's price-to-book is at 1.4. The company's price-to-sales is at 1.1. The company's price-to-cash flow is at 2.5. And the company has a dividend yield of 14.1%. When we compare Petrobras' current valuation to its 5-year average, we can see that Petrobras is undervalued based on its price-to-earnings and price-to-cash-flow metrics. Lastly, if we compare Petrobras' current valuation to the S&P 500, an S&P 500 is the aggregate of the top 500 companies in the United States, and we can think of the S&P 500 as our opportunity cost. On all the valuation metrics, we can see that Petrobras is undervalued when compared to the S&P 500. Now let's look at Petrobras' discounted-free cash flow DCF analysis. Over here, I pasted the company's 3-year average from 2018 to 2020 free cash flow number that I got from Morningstar, which was $13,017 million. I'm using an annual growth rate of free cash flow to be 4%. What this means is I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 4% every year for the next 10 years. I'm using a discount rate of 10%. What this means is I expect to get a 10% return on this investment. Another way to think about a discount rate is that I expect my investment to double in about 7 years. Next, I'm using the company's long-term growth rate to be 2.161%. What this means is after the 10-year mark into perpetuity, I expect the company's free cash flow to grow at 2.161%. This number is in line with the U.S. 30-year Treasury yield. Petrobras has 6,522 million shares outstanding, and the company has a long-term debt of $49,702 million. After taking all of these inputs into account, we get the company's intrinsic value to be about $21.27 per share. And when we compare this intrinsic value to the company's current stock price, which is about $14.51 per share, we can see that the company's current stock is trading about 32% below the company's intrinsic value. The way we calculate this intrinsic value is we look at what the free cash flows would be every year for the next 10 years. We sum up all those free cash flows, which come out to about $97 billion. Then we look at what the free cash flows would be after the 10-year mark into perpetuity. We sum all those up to get the intrinsic value to be about $188 billion. From this number, we subtract the long-term debt and divide by the shares outstanding to get the intrinsic value per share to be about $21 per share. If we disregard the perpetuity component, in other words, if you think that Petrobras is only going to grow for the next 10 years and then it'll cease to exist, then we get the intrinsic value without the perpetuity to be about $7 per share. If we disregard the debt, in other words, if you think that Petrobras is going to grow into perpetuity, so there is no point for the company to worry about paying off its debt, then we get the intrinsic value without the debt to be about $29 per share. Finally, let's try to see what kind of return can we expect to get if we were to invest in the security at the current stock price. In order to do that, I will run a goal-seek analysis. I'll set myself to the intrinsic value. I'll set my two value to the company's current stock price, which is $14.51 per share. And I'll run this analysis by changing the company's discount rate. When I run this analysis, I get the company's discount rate to be about 12.26%. What this means is if I were to purchase the security at the current stock price, I can expect to get an annual return of about 12% on this investment. Overall, Petrobras has good fundamentals. Petrobras is undervalued not only from a current valuation standpoint, but also when we looked at the company's discounted free cash flow DCF analysis, we saw that the company is undervalued. After its 2014 corruption scandal, Petrobras has greatly improved its operating margins. It has paid down a lot of its debt. It has divested from its non-core assets. It has curtailed its spending, eliminated many jobs, and it also began paying out dividends to its common shareholders. However, it's important to realize that Brazil is still an emerging market, and investing in ADR has its currency risk. For instance, if the Brazilian real were to depreciate in value against the US dollar, then the ADR, which is denominated in US dollars, would also depreciate in value, even though the Brazilian stock, which is traded on the Brazilian exchange, may still be valued at the same stock price. Lastly, Brazil and other Latin American countries have a big issue with corruption. And just because Petrobras had a bitter history with corruption does not mean that it would never be associated with any corrupt practices in the future. Hey guys, that is all I had for you this week. Hopefully you found this video on Petrobras interesting. If you like this content, please do like, share, comment, and subscribe. And if you have any suggestions on which stock I should review next, please leave them in the comment section below. I'll greatly appreciate it. Thank you.